You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a club at UW-Milwaukee is focusing on getting girls interested in computer science. We'll talk to one of the organizers.
First, a vote of no confidence passed overwhelmingly among UW-Madison faculty on Monday. The vote was an open show of disapproval of UW System President Ray Cross and the Board of Regents. And that conversation is likely to continue among faculty at other UW schools, for instance, at UW-Milwaukee next week.
But Republican state lawmakers, including Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinecke, have shown disappointment in the faculty's decision, called the vote disappointing.
WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White joins us now. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Judah.
So, which legislators have been the most vocal about the vote of no confidence?
Well, Rob just mentioned Representative Steinecke, who is the Assembly Majority Leader. He has been very vocal. He was speaking out against the resolution last week, even before the vote. And Senator Steve Noss, who's the Vice Chairman of the Senate's Higher Education Committee, has also voiced opposition to the resolution.
Well, let's take a listen to what Representative Steinecke said to you earlier.
I think it shows that they're a little out of touch with the average Wisconsin citizen who doesn't have the job protections that they have through tenure.
And so, Laurel, tell us more about what he was talking about there. Why was he saying that he thinks the faculty is out of touch?
Sure. So last week, as I mentioned, before the vote, he put out a statement saying that he wasn't in favor of it. And he said that the vote would be a clear example of the disconnect between UW-Madison faculty who expect their job to come with a forever guarantee. You know, he's talking about tenure there, versus the average Wisconsin family who's just struggling to make ends meet. So he's sort of continuing on that theme after the resolution passed, that it just proves that faculty are out of touch with most Wisconsinites.
So do you get the sense at all that he realizes or recognizes, or that other legislators do, that there is something different about teaching in a university where, you know, there's this kind of great churning of ideas and different perspectives versus a regular everyday job that most of the rest of us have?
Sure. I think that his reaction to that is that the changes to the tenure policy were pretty modest where the legislature was concerned. And then he has said, in fact, in his statement last week, that the changes that the regents made to the tenure policy were minor. So I think his response to that, and of course, I'm just speculating, is that, you know, the changes weren't huge, and that he does respect the UW and the mission, and this shouldn't have that much of an impact on it.
Representative Steinecke also commented on the political implications of that no confidence vote.
I think at a time when legislators would like to move closer to the university, I think this has the effect of pushing back against the legislature a little bit.
So, Laurel, this comes after Republican lawmakers removed tenure from state law last year, made it easier for chancellors to lay off staff. Is there a sense that this vote was in opposition to more than the president and the Board of Regents and more immediate recent actions?
I think what the vote was, and I wasn't at the vote itself, but I spoke with my colleague Parth Shah, who was. He said that it seemed to be more a reaction to President Cross and the regents not fighting back against the legislative changes to tenure and the $250 million budget cut to the university system as well. So I think it was more a reaction to university leadership than the legislature itself, saying that university leadership should have been more of an advocate for the faculty and the university throughout that process.
So more that the people that the faculty saw as the ones that should be their champions against the legislature or with the legislature were not doing the job.
Right.
We're talking with Laurel White. She is WPR's State Capitol reporter. Now, Laurel, it seems like both sides are arguing that it's them who is protecting the interests of Wisconsinites. How are they approaching or kind of spinning that differently?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, Republican legislators are saying that, you know, they're making common sense cuts to the UW system, making sure that it's running efficiently and that taxpayers aren't investing an undue amount of money in the system. And professors are pushing back and saying that they can't work in a system that they don't feel supported in. Tenure changes are compromising their ability to do controversial research, and that these changes are actually compromising the reputation of the University of Wisconsin system all around the country.
And let's also talk about Whitewater Senator Steve Nass. You mentioned him earlier as another person who's expressed disappointment and unhappiness with the vote of no confidence. He released a statement last week saying that, quote, the radical faculty at UW-Madison are rejecting the values and expectations of the people of Wisconsin, end quote. How is this decision being seen as at odds with what legislators say is best for the state overall?
Well, I think, you know, legislators are saying that, you know, the university system needs to run more efficiently and that these changes are contributing to that. And the faculty are really pushing back and saying that what they're doing is trying to protect the Wisconsin idea, that if those cuts continue, if more changes happen, that the legislature is just detracting from the university's reputation.
And Laurel, very briefly, do you think that this vote is going to come up in the next budget cycle discussions that are going to start soon?
You know, in Senator Nass's statement last week, he actually said passage of the resolution will prove that more institutional reforms are needed. So I think we can count on this vote coming up in budget discussions.
Well, Laurel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR's State Capitol reporter Laurel White talking with us about the state GOP's response to the UW-Madison faculty's vote of no confidence this week. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about a club at UW-Milwaukee that aims to get more girls interested in computer science.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. In the 1880s, the 8-hour workday emerged as the prime focus of the labor movement. Historian John Goethe reminds us of the tragedy that accompanied the fight in Milwaukee's Bayview neighborhood.
We gather each year to remember a tragedy. The date is always the same, the Sunday nearest May 5th, and so is the place, the site of a vanished iron mill in Milwaukee's Bayview neighborhood. Even the people are generally the same, a motley crew that includes union activists, professors, politicians, and assorted Bayviewites. The tragedy we remember took place in the first week of May 1886. For a few days in that long-ago spring, Milwaukee was practically unhinged. A general strike, affecting everyone from bakers to brewers, began on May 1st and soon brought the city to a grinding halt. On May 2nd, nearly 15,000 strikers staged the largest parade in Milwaukee's history to that point. By May 4th, after a series of less peaceful demonstrations, Governor Jeremiah Rusk had called out the militia. One day later, horrified spectators witnessed the bloodiest labor disturbance in Wisconsin's history. What issue could have aroused such passions? Nothing more or less than the 8-hour day. Milwaukee was a stronghold of the 8-hour agitation, swept the nation in 1886. Most workers of the time routinely put in 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, for only a dollar or two a day. Not surprisingly, they wanted an 8-hour day without a cut in pay. Labor's core demand was expressed in a simple slogan, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will. By the morning of May 5th, the unrest had shut down every major Milwaukee employer but one, a massive iron plant in suburban Bayview. The strikers resolved to bring the mill's leaders to heel. Nearly 1,500 people, mostly Polish immigrants, gathered at St. Stanislaus Church on the corner of 5th and Mitchell for a brisk morning walk to Bayview. They found the militia waiting for them. The troops had spent an uneasy night inside the plant gates, and in the morning they received a chilling order: pick out your man and kill him. As the crowd surged down Bay Street toward the mill, the militia commander ordered them to disperse. At a distance of 200 yards, the marchers couldn't possibly have heard them above their own noise. When they continued to advance, the troops opened fire. At least 7 people fell dead or dying, including a 12-year-old schoolboy and a retired millworker who was watching the commotion from his backyard. The rest of the crowd beat a hasty retreat to the city. The Bayview shootings ended, for the time being, the campaign for the 8-hour day, but they galvanized Milwaukee's workers. In the very next election, the brand new People's Party swept the races for Congress, state legislature, and Milwaukee County government. Although their triumph was temporary, it was the first tremor in a political earthquake that led to the socialist landslide of 1910. We'll be gathering on the corner of Russell and Superior for speeches, songs, and a reenactment. We'll remember a tragedy, of course, but we'll recall something even larger, the true cost of the eight-hour day.
John Gerda is an award-winning Milwaukee historian and the author of many books, including Milwaukee, City of Neighborhoods. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Now, back in 1984, 37% of all computer science graduates were women. Today, that number is down to 18%, according to a national organization focused on getting girls interested in the field.
Girls Who Code is a national organization aimed at closing the gender gap in the technology world, and educators at UW-Milwaukee recently set up a club to help achieve that goal.
Christine Cheng joins us now. She's Associate Professor of Computer Science at UW-Milwaukee and one of the organizers of UWM's Girls Who Code Club. Christine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So how does Girls Who Code try to inspire girls, young women, to get into computer science?
Okay, so let me kind of briefly say how it got started, and then I'll get into that.
Sure.
So the founder of Girls Who Code is Reshma Saujani, and she's a kind of a politician in New York City. And it started from a very basic observation that when she started visiting classrooms who teach where coding is taught, she noticed that it's mostly boys, and the main question was, where's the girls? And so the goal of Girls Who Code is to expose girls as young as, like, in our club, as young as fourth grade all the way to high school, to expose them to coding, to see how interesting it is, to see what you could do with this skill.
And why did you want to get involved in Milwaukee with the local program?
Our department's been a participant of an organization. Well, it's not an organization, but an initiative called BRAID, and the idea is to increase more women in our computer science program. And so it was very much in line with the goal of so the issue with computer science is that there's a pipeline issue. We're not having a lot of girls in college because there's not a lot of girls in high school who's doing computer science, because there's not a lot of girls in middle school who's interested in computer science. So you kind of have to build the pipeline.
Why do you think that is? Starting at that early age, why aren't we seeing more girls involved in coding, in computer science?
So there's many issues. I think one of them is a perception issue. Not many girls understand what computer science is all about. So, for example, in one of my classes, I asked my student, what do you think the public's perception of a computer scientist is? And one of my students raised his hand and said, well, it's the image of a guy in his basement where it's all dark. He's working on his computer, drinking Mountain Dew. So I think that's very much still in the public's view of what computer science is all about, and we need to correct that. We need to show them that it's actually interesting work, that there's a lot of the work that's done in computer science has a social component, that you're trying to improve people's lives and so forth.
Now, you, of course, are a computer scientist and a woman yourself. I was looking at a list of your publications. There are a lot of things that I do not understand, definitely. But how important is it to have a role model like you up there in front of the girls so they can see, oh, yeah, a computer science scientist can be a woman?
I think it's really important. So let me just say, too, that it's not just me who's running Girls Who Code. I have two instructors, who one's an undergraduate and the other is a graduate student in our program. And then I have a pool of 10 volunteers, all women, who are also from our program. They week in, week out, they help us. So I think for a young girl, it's important to recognize that there are women and in some sense plenty of women who's interested in this field, so that they don't feel like they're the only one in the room, or they're the only one, I don't know, in their school who's interested in it. I think one of the things that I've seen in the program is, or one of the fun things that I've seen is that they are getting to know each other, even though they're from different schools. And I think that's a real encouragement to them that that it's worth pursuing this interest.
We're talking to computer science professor Christine Cheng from UW-Milwaukee about girls who code. And Christine, what actually happens when girls join this club? What do they do? What kind of projects? What kind of education?
So we make use of a particular platform from codesters.com. So it's already set up. And what we do is our teachers at the very beginning would do like a 15-minute quote-unquote lecture where they point out the important parts of today's lesson. And then the girls spend about 45 minutes coding. And then we have a break, and then again, like a 10 to 15 minute recap of what happened, and then they spend the rest of the time coding as well. So what's really interesting with this particular platform, and there's plenty of platforms out there, is that the girls can get to do something really interesting immediately, which was very different from our experience. Like for me and a lot of my colleagues, when we learned how to code, it was a black screen and we were typing things and trying to make things appear on that black screen. But now there's a lot of platforms where they get to see a lot of animation. They make things move, and they get to do interactive stuff where you ask the user input, and a lot of interesting things will happen on the screen. So it's kind of a really interesting time right now in the K-12 education, and that there's a lot of products out there that will enhance the learning of coding.
And then starting with that platform, are they working towards skills that would apply toward computer programming languages that they might use in academics or in a future job?
Definitely. So with codesters.com, they're using Python as the main language, which is a language already used in industry. So they're getting to know the language. They're getting to know the concepts, the most important concepts in coding, without it being very very dry. Without it being it's a drag and drop method for writing your code. So they avoid the mistake that typically baffles initial learners of coding, where you mistype something and then mm-hmm. you're spending 30 minutes trying to figure out what's wrong with it. So this drag and drop sort of improves the experience significantly.
So you've worked with girls in the Girls Who Code Club. What do you see? How do you see them change over the course of this?
I think for a lot of them, it's gaining a good understanding of what coding is all about, and the ability to create things. I think that's really exciting for them. I know that for some of our high school students, it's a way for them to figure out if, for example, they want to do AP computer science, or if they want to pursue a computing-related field in college. So it kind of opens their eyes and see what the field is all about.
Are you getting a lot of interest in Girls Who Code in the Milwaukee area?
We are. So we're not the only one running a Girls Who Code club. Marquette was actually the first one to do so, and with their help, we started ours. When we had an information session in January, we were expecting about 50 people to come at our information session. And it something like 110 showed up.
Wow!
So there was really this excitement in the air when we did the information session. I think both the parents recognize it's a skill they want their kids to have, and then I think the girls themselves were very interested in learning how to code.
What are your hopes for the future of the program?
We hope to grow it. We hope to reach. I think. Girls, and in fact, not just girls, but boys as well, who don't get this exposure to coding And so we're so my colleague and I, Professor John Boyland, are talking about how we could scale the program so we could reach I think more underrepresented groups, because that's the key, trying to increase diversity in computer science.
And is it your hope that eventually some of these club members will be showing up in your college classrooms?
Definitely. I think we already know that two of them are going to do computer science or computer engineering at UWM. But I think my hope is that they would take the skill and combine it with their passions. So I have a girl in the program who said that she's interested in political science or computer science. And even if she chooses political science, I think coding is a skill that she could bring into the field. Like if you think about Nate Silver and all the number crunching he's doing, he's definitely doing coding behind the scenes. So you're going to be a much better political scientist if you have coding skills than if you don't. And I think that's the idea, is to use coding to enhance what your passion is.
Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Christine Cheng, computer science professor and head of the Girls Who Code Club at UW-Milwaukee.
Coming up, there are many movements, like a demand for organics and the push for fair trade products, that focus on items as they come to market. But with 40% of food wasted in the U.S., some are saying that there should be as much emphasis on where those items end up. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up after 7, it's this week's edition of Snap Judgment, with more intriguing stories about the defining moments in people's lives. That's tonight after 7, here on the Ideas Network.
First, many movements and philosophies that look at capitalism and the market focus on the production end of the equation. There are efforts to promote organic and humane food production, or to make sure that agricultural and food workers get a living wage.
There is not as much focus on what happens with the products after they enter the market, whether that's a grocery store or a restaurant. And when there is, it often centers on individual behaviors, like being vegetarian or vegan.
Well, one group of people is calling all of that into question. They say that with 40% of the food produced in the United States ending up in the garbage, there needs to be a fundamental shift in the system. They say that includes taking a hard look at what's considered garbage and waste.
Alex Barnard joins us now. He's a doctoral candidate in sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and a food justice activist. He's the author of Freegans, Diving into the Wealth of Food Waste in America. Alex, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So, Alex, first of all, let's talk about that term freegan, and it's spelled F-R-E-E-G-A-N for people who aren't familiar with it. What does it mean?
Well, there's certainly no official definition of freegan, so I can just tell you, you know, what the people I met meant when they used the term. So it's a term that started as kind of a combination of the words free and vegan. So the idea of veganism is that if you object to the way animals are treated, you should stop buying animal products. And freeganism was sort of an extension to that, to say if you object more generally to the way things are produced in our economic system, you should stop buying anything. But, you know, to try and make it a little more precise, you know, I studied a particular group of people calling themselves freegans in New York City. And what they were most known for doing was actually dumpster diving food. So taking food that was discarded mostly by supermarkets or other retailers, and recovering it as sort of an act of protest against the waste in our food system.
So you said that the second half of freegan comes from vegan, and it also rhymes, so it goes together nicely. Are all freegans vegan?
Not necessarily. One thing that I found in my research, though, was that a lot of people came to freeganism through the pathway of veganism. And as it turned out, as I delved further into it, I discovered that was a really important part of the story, which is that things like veganism are part of kind of a wave of, you know, what we could call ethical consumption. It's people who have decided that sort of their best way to find a way to change the world, to contribute to positive changes, is through buying things. It's through buying things differently, whether it's buying things that are organic, buying things that are vegan, buying things that are fair trade. And Freegans, often they started off, you know, seeing that as the solution. But as time went on, they became more and more disillusioned with that. They began to doubt whether, as individual consumers buying sort of what was on offer, deciding to buy the organic produce rather than the conventional produce, they began to doubt whether or not that was really going to change things. And so a lot of them wound up moving beyond veganism. And the thing that triggered that switch was actually discovering that there's all this waste. Because if you think about it, the idea behind ethical consumption is that, you know, if you decide you're going to buy kale rather than bacon, the company is going to take account of your preference that you express at the cash register, and they're going to transform their production to take into account of that change in the demand for products. But what we see with waste is that markets aren't nearly that efficient, actually, that what gets produced in our food system isn't actually sort of a natural and rapid reflection of what people want. And that realization was something that led Freegans to look for sort of more radical types of activism.
So let's dive into waste, so to speak, focusing on food, because there's so much that we could talk about. But I think food is a really important aspect of this. How much food is estimated to be wasted in the U.S. every year?
Well, it's a little bit fuzzy because part of it depends on how you decide to define waste. So, for example, there are some people who say it's a waste that we feed grain to animals, because if you give a cow, you know, 8 calories of grain, you're only going to get 1 calorie of beef in response. But if you say take sort of the conventional definition of waste, you know, food that was produced for people but doesn't wind up getting eaten by people, it's about 40% of food production in the U.S. You know, if you think that the average person eats about 2,000 calories per person per day, imagine that means about 1,500 calories per person per day are produced in the United States and never eaten.
And on the other hand, I believe that the figures are about 1 in 6 people in the U.S. suffers from hunger or lack of access to enough food.
Yes. So, you know, obviously we have this, you know, this paradox of a system that produces at the same time a lot of scarcity and a lot of excess. And in fact, those two are related in the sense that we have a system that is ultimately focused around, you know, production for profit rather than thinking about, you know, what people actually need. And that's sort of one of the things that Freegans were protesting against.
So, Alex, you talk about the fact that we're taught that the capitalist system is based on efficiency and profit, both of which on the surface would seem to be the opposite of waste. But you actually say that waste is, in fact, a key part and an essential part of today's capitalism. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, well, again, these are realizations that came out of my research, that came out of the time I spent from Freegans and listening to them and trying to understand what made this possible. Because there is something that seems totally irrational about the fact that Freeganism is something that you can do, because it would seem to make sense that, you know, if stores are producing too much, why wouldn't they just produce a little bit less, save on their costs, and therefore make a bigger profit? And what I discovered is that, you know, sadly, when you look in the dumpsters, you realize that producing waste is part of the business model in our food system, and sadly, it's a rational profit-making decision for a lot of companies. I think the best example is baked goods. So, you know, I was doing my research in New York City, so there's a Dunkin' Donuts about every 10 feet there, and every night you can find just about every flavor of donut that you could possibly imagine outside those stores. So why is it that those stores don't just produce some fewer donuts? And the answer is, you know, that the raw materials for those products are so cheap because of farm subsidies, because of, you know, how little that we pay laborers in the food system, that they can actually afford to overproduce donuts or cakes or what have you. And they do that so that if somebody comes in 5 minutes before the store closes, they'll have whatever flavor of donut that person could demand. So it's actually a profit-making strategy, but one with these sort of you know, that produces waste, but even more seriously has these ecological consequences of all the resources that are going to produce food that we don't actually wind up eating.
And in the book, Alex, you talk about the fact that people in retail grocery industries will admit that they would much rather waste, I think it's 15%, they assume a waste of 15% of their product instead of losing that one customer who might, because they don't find a donut in their store, go down that block or two blocks and buy a donut somewhere else and maybe just keep going to that other place after.
Yeah, well, I mean, I want to emphasize it's not because store managers or store employees or corporate executives are necessarily malicious. We live in an economic system where the thing that we demand from our companies is that they're profitable. And it's a very competitive market. The entire food system is extremely competitive. Traditional grocery stores are facing, on the one hand, competition from stores like Walmart, and they're, you know, that traditionally didn't sell food. And they're also facing competition from people who are eating out more. And so they're afraid of losing customers. And they're afraid that if somebody comes in and is not satisfied with their customer experience, they're going to go elsewhere. So that's part of why it's so important for stores to create this image that they're selling abundance, that they have unlimited choice. And it's at the same time the image that the Freegans were trying to challenge by recovering this food and displaying it publicly and showing sort of this darker underbelly of, you know, the abundance that our food system would seem to provide.
We're talking with Alex Barnard. He's the author of Freegans, Diving into the Wealth of Food Waste in America.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this level of food waste in your life, maybe in your work? Do you think our guest is right that we should be taking a closer look at food waste in America, how we decide if an item is a valuable commodity or ends up being garbage? Can you imagine, have you taken cast-off food home to eat, maybe from out behind the donut or the grocery store? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about food waste and reclaiming products that in another setting would be desirable purchases. Our guest is Alex Barnard, author of Freegans, Diving into the Wealth of Food Waste in America. Now, Alex, you talked about in your book how the Freegan principles are actually very close to our country's earlier generations' values. How does that put together for you?
Well, I think that, you know, this was something that the Freegans themselves evoked, that on the one hand, they were, you know, very radical people who denounced capitalism. Some of them claimed they were anarchists. But on the other hand, you know, when they're talking about the idea of thrift and non-wasting and careful conservation of resources, you know, they themselves would say, you know, aren't values that seem that radical, actually. You know, these are the values of our grandparents' generation. And perhaps that's a somewhat idealized portrait of the way things used to be. But it is true that, you know, the amount of food waste that we see, you know, according to the statistics, has increased a lot over the, you know, recent generations. And one interpretation of that would be that, well, consumers have gotten much more wasteful. They don't, you know, they don't care as much about food. But another interpretation would be that there's actually been these structural changes in our food system in terms of the way food is being produced, in terms of the way farm subsidies are set up, that have meant that, you know, food really has lost its value in the sense that it has become, you know, more and more common. You know, it has become more and more built into our system that food would go to waste like this.
So Zach on Facebook said, I am 100% for this movement. I have, quote unquote, dived for food and never gotten sick. If you take the proper precautions, you shouldn't ever get sick. Also, how many Americans buy food from a store that gets them sick anyways? Zach says, save landfills and your wallet. Alex, what would you say to Zach?
Well, I think that, you know, that is often the first thing that gets raised, which is that, you know, don't people get sick from dumpster diving? And I can say, you know, both in terms of my personal experience and having talked to a lot of Freegans, that, you know, if you pay attention and you use your senses, it's, you know, I haven't encountered a lot of people who have gotten sick from it. And it is true also that, you know, there are problems with the safety of food that isn't coming from a dumpster. So obviously, I'm very, you know, very much in agreement with that comment.
And that's a lot of what you talk about in the book, Alex, is how food waste, or waste food, really, has been fetishized as something dangerous and dirty and undesirable, whereas it could be the same tomato that just was on a shelf 5 minutes earlier. Someone could have bought it, but didn't, and now it's in the garbage.
Well, I think that's part of, you know, what drew me to freeganism itself. You know, I have to be honest, the first time I went to a freegan trash tour, there are these events that are organized in New York City where the freegans would actually take people outside of stores and show them how to dumpster dive and do a little display of all the things they found. The first time I went, I kind of thought that maybe we were going to find some banana peels and some rotten lettuce and, you know, some half-eaten loaves of bread or something. And actually, there was this incredible abundance of food that looked exactly like the food that I would have bought if I had gone into the store 5 minutes earlier. And I think that was a shocking realization. It's been a shocking realization for hundreds of people who have come on these freegan trash tours, to realize that the reason things are thrown out is not that they're not edible. It's not because they're dangerous. It's because they can't be profitably sold. That's the root cause of food waste.
Let's go to
that we produce food that, in the end, is more profitable to throw out than to give to hungry people or to sell.
Let's go to the phones, and Dennis in Appleton is with us. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Wondered if there's any data as far as waste in school service food programs.
And that's a great question, Dennis, and I think could be expanded into, you know, other institutions, too. Alex, is there any study done on that?
There is. I'm afraid that I can't give it to you off the top of my head, but institutional restaurants are a serious source of waste, and there's been a lot of reflection about, particularly in terms of schools, what are different things that could be used to reduce waste. So there's been talk about, you know, whether recess should happen before or after lunch. And it turns out that if you have recess before lunch, that reduces food waste. You know, things like that. But I don't have it off the top of my head, I'm afraid.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Alex, you're joining us from France, where you're living and doing research. Recently, France has a new law that says that grocery stores must donate discarded food instead of throwing it out, and that they can't intentionally spoil food by pouring bleach on it, for example, to prevent people from foraging. Do you think that's something you could see working in the U.S. or maybe on a smaller scale in some communities?
Well, we already see that in the U.S. The impact of movements like freegans and some more mainstream movements, but this sort of general ferment of people who are taking more interest in food and that are, you know, raising consciousness about the question of waste. We can already see that, you know, there are some cities like Seattle that have put into place food waste bans, and there are other sorts of initiatives that are happening. But I think we have to remember that, you know, these are things that are going to come from public pressure. It's often, you know, especially in terms of ethical consumption, we often think, oh, companies are just going to do this because it makes good business sense. But no.
Sorry, we have to end it there. Alex, thanks for joining us today. Alex Barnard is the author of Freegans, Diving into the Wealth of Food Waste in America.
As farmers markets open around the state, one thing Wisconsinites won't see among the items at their local markets are homemade bread, cookies, or muffins. Wisconsin is one of two states that prohibit the sale of baked goods made in home kitchen. As Hope Kerwin reports, some farmers feel the law also limits economic growth in rural communities.
Della Inns owns and operates Scotch Hill Farm near Broadhead in southern Wisconsin. In addition to organic vegetables, Inns Small Farm has several projects that help bring in extra income.
And we raise a variety of heritage chickens for eggs that go in our CSA. Eggs that also could be used for baking.
Enns is one of three farmers suing the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection over the state's ban on selling baked goods made in home kitchens. They say the ban is unconstitutional because the state already allows sales of things like homemade canned goods and maple syrup. The lawsuit also points out the state classifies items like bread, cookies, or muffins as not potentially hazardous, which they say negates the idea that home operations are a food safety hazard. Chris Marion, another farmer on the lawsuit, says prohibiting the sale of baked goods means rural communities are missing out on needed economic growth.
A farmer's market in little towns like mine inspires, kind of incubates little businesses. So people are baking at home. They bring their goods at home. They get to test their recipes without making a big investment in a kitchen.
And with more people buying local and the rising popularity of farm-to-table businesses, Marion says people are already okay with any risk that comes from buying items not made in a commercial kitchen.
And I think people actually assume that when they go to a market and buy something at a little stand from their neighbor, that their neighbor has made that in their kitchen.
But food industry advocates say the state can't ensure food safety in home kitchens. And Dave Schmidt, CEO of the Wisconsin Bakers Association, says that could negatively impact all bakeries.
If a food crisis breaks out, it gives a black eye to the entire industry.
Schmidt says allowing people to bake out of their homes also impacts companies trying to open a more traditional bakery.
All the small business bakery operations that are out there across the state that are paying licensing and regulation fees and are required to do the things that they have to get started in business, it really puts them at an unfair advantage.
In the last few years, many states have passed laws creating more freedom for cottage food operations. Take Illinois, for example. The state passed the Illinois Cottage Food Operation Law back in 2012, and last year increased the amount of money home-based operations can make and created a task force to approve more items for the cottage food industry. Dale Hazelwood is vice president of the Illinois Farmers Market Association. He says cottage food vendors have brought back the popularity of local businesses.
Farmers markets are going back to what we used to, where we have all these little mom-and-pop businesses, lots of specialty items that you can't get anywhere else.
Illinois doesn't keep track of how many cottage food businesses are operating in the state, but Hazelwood said he's definitely seen an increase in vendors at his local market, and several cottage food operations have even grown into brick-and-mortar businesses. 25 miles from the Wisconsin-Illinois border, Chris Marion checks on her sheep despite the rainy weather. In addition to selling vegetables and wool, Marion operates a bed and breakfast on her farm and teaches knitting classes. She says small family farms have always had to be creative about where their money comes from.
You need to have something in every season and something for all different parts of your property and operations.
The farmer's lawsuit is still in the early stages, and a court date hasn't been set yet. But Marion says she hopes the process will start a conversation among legislators and other stakeholders about how traditional bakeries and cottage food operations can coexist. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.